Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking to New Mexico Lands Commissioner Ray Powell. We'll also be talking to musician Joe West and hearing a little bit of his music, and Lexi Shabell, founder of the Breast Wishes Fund. I'm happy now to welcome back to the program Eric Maddox. He's a filmmaker, journalist. He's founder of the Virtual Dinner Guest Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked about the first Virtual Dinner Guest Project that you did. Just remind us what it is.
Sure. In a nutshell, it's connecting people from around the world at their dinner tables using video conferencing technology, Skype, for now, because it's free and widely available.
So we have a dinner party. We're sitting in Santa Fe. Your first dinner party, the other part of the dinner party was in Juarez, Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. Everybody is eating dinner and talking to each other through Skype. And there's some people at the table and then other people sitting around the edge kind of witnessing it because you can't put 57 people at a table.
That's more or less it. That's more or less the setup. I would maybe insert one minor correction in that I prefer not to refer to it as a dinner party, just given like the gravity of some of the subjects that are discussed. The format, the forum itself is certainly an informal one, and was chosen with much intent behind it. But at the same time, I mean, in our discussion with the family in Juarez, I mean, they're talking about having lost family members in the drug war, and a wide range of issues related to border issues right now between the U.S. and Mexico. So while the forum is somewhat informal and intentionally informal, the conversations can kind of run the gamut, can be intense, can be political.
Well, how did the last one go? What did you talk about? I mean, that's how it was? You got into all these intense subjects?
Yes, I think we got into intense subjects, but it was done in a way that was respectful, I think. And on both ends, people were allowed to ask all the charged questions they wanted, and I think that it was that we had a positive outcome. As far as the content, it really did range the gamut. We talked about everything from immigration coming from Mexico into the U.S. to immigration coming from Guatemala and Central America into Mexico. We talked about the wall. We talked about American appetite for Mexican drugs and their appetite for our guns, at least the cartel's appetite for our guns. And we talked about how spicy their menudo was. And enjoyed some burritos on our end, and so there were definitely some lighter moments, but yeah, I was careful as the moderator in this discussion, and I will continue to be for the foreseeable future in our continuing discussions with other countries. I wanted to make sure that while there was some levity in the conversation, that we didn't shy away from like the meaty stuff.
So the next one that you're doing, which is on Saturday, October 22nd, and it's at the Zane Bennett Contemporary Art Gallery, is with some people whom you met who live in Uganda, who are from Uganda.
I have not met them in person. I've met one of the facilitators in person. But I've met them over Skype a few times through this contact at the UN, who's actually herself from Uganda but stationed in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And she put me in touch with some of her friends back in Kampala in Uganda. So, yes, The participating community on the other end of the dinner table this time around will be a group from Kampala, Uganda.
Now, you are looking for, and this is part of the reason we're doing the radio broadcast now, you are looking for dinner guests. What kind of folks are you looking for?
Well, I would like to have at least one or two East Africans represented at the table. And if there's any Ugandans living here locally, meaning, I guess, Albuquerque or Santa Fe or your Taos area, and points between, that would be great. No expert opinions are required here whatsoever, but some cultural fluency and a willingness to maybe function as like a cultural bridge would be most welcome. And then I guess also anyone that has any direct African experience, again, more specifically in East Africa or Uganda, whether that's in a formal capacity as a business person or having maybe worked for the State Department or just maybe they traveled there, did the Peace Corps there.
I know somebody who did, she doesn't live here unfortunately, but who lived there for years doing public health work.
That would be perfect.
Yeah. So you are looking for dinner guests, and of course everybody is also invited to sit around and kind of witness and take part, and then there's a question and answer thing at the end. How can people get in touch with you if they would like to be guests at this virtual dinner?
Sure. The easiest way would be just to go to, to email me, and that's info@virtualdinnerguest.com. They can also go to the Facebook page, so on Facebook, go to the Virtual Dinner Guest Project, and there's a website as well, which is virtualdinnerguest.com.
All right, well, so if somebody just simply does a search for Virtual Dinner Guest, they'll get there.
They'll get there somehow.
All right, good. So you are a finalist in a phenomenon that has hit Santa Fe recently called Spread, which is at Site Santa Fe. What's that all about?
What that's all about is a micro grant competition. This is the second one they've done, so it's called Spread 2.0. If people are familiar with Meow Wolf and their offering, they were the winners of the last round of Spread. They put on this, what was it, Do Return, like this kind of surrealistic pirate ship.
That was so cool.
It was cool. So that's what they did with the money that they got from the Spread event the first time around. I would obviously, if I were lucky enough to win, put the money into promoting future dinners with other countries, and I have several lined up as it is.
What's the next one after Uganda?
The next one will probably be a return to Juarez.
Okay.
Dinner
the
number
same
two
people.
With a local restaurant functioning as like the food provider and as the venue. And I'm currently talking to a group in Liberia. Their organization is headed out of D.C. It's called the More Than Me Foundation, and they work getting preteen child prostitutes off the streets of the slums of Monrovia into schools. So this would be an opportunity for us to, in cooperation with their organization, kind of highlight some of those issues and talk to people on the ground in Liberia. Lebanon is another one that I'm working on as well.
What do you hope to accomplish by these person-to-person contacts?
Just some global peace and justice.
That's all?
I think that I see it serving a number of functions. One is an alternative to the mainstream treatment or ill treatment or lack of treatment that so many of the world's conflicts don't enjoy. And an opportunity for people to kind of engage with real human beings behind the headlines, put a face to some of the conflicts that they may be hearing about or the ones that they're not hearing about. And I see it as a mechanism also for accountability for where our taxpayer dollars are going abroad. So often the conversation is between elites in both cultural contexts. And I've seen firsthand the UN is one of the more dysfunctional bureaucracies on the planet, rife with corruption. So this is an opportunity for citizens from one country to talk to citizens of another country, and if you happen to be from a donor country and in a recipient country, you could say, so where's that money going? Is it getting
right
to where it's supposed to? Did it go to providing the seeds or whatever so you could plow this field or building that rural health clinic? So it's a mechanism for aid accountability and also identifying grassroots initiatives that are worthy of funding but maybe below the radar of large-scale organizations like the UN because they don't have a six-figure budget or higher.
There's another part of it for me, which is that, and this is something that's, I guess, been such a big part of my own life, when you get to know people from different places, then you have a kind of affection and knowledge about that place and that country, and it's impossible to dehumanize them, as is necessary when you fight a war against somebody, you have to dehumanize them. This is kind of like inoculation against that.
I think you've more or less, like, literally taking the words out of my mouth. One of the things that I've said over and over again about this project is that it's harder to ignore, vilify, or harm those with whom we've broken bread. And there's a lot of intent behind the forum that I've chosen. If you think about it, the dinner table is the world's oldest and the most universal social forum that there is.
Yeah.
And it can be a place where people have heated debates. And it can also be a place where if you're nervous and don't have much to say, you just take another mouthful, you know?
Right, as we all know. And there is also something which is, I mean, I think that aid organizations and the UN, corrupt as it is in some places, whatever, you know, they help. But there is also the kind of help that happens from person to person, which in my view, is kind of what makes the world go around. Because if that's not there, these other things don't work.
Absolutely agree. I think if you look at what's happened maybe like in the last couple of decades with the information age and what's happened with the internet, and even before then, our economic and political destinies on this planet as the citizens of the world have become more and more connected and more efficient in how we express them on a daily basis. But unfortunately, I think our emotional and our intellectual investments in one another have not kept pace. We have things like Facebook, but how are we using them? So in some ways, the mechanisms are in place, but they're underutilized for the kinds of things that could really prevent conflict and promote clarity of communication and the blowback that comes from how we show up in kind of limited ways in certain parts of the world, but don't really give people a chance to, when I say know us, I guess I mean the West.
Yeah.
So this is an opportunity to kind of not change the dynamic, but maybe allow it for it to be a little more multifaceted. And if we are, if we do have emotional, think about it this way, like my grandfather's generation, like he was a country doctor, right? And my grandfather's generation, you had the person down the road who provided your eggs. Maybe their neighbor was the one that provided your health care. The people that you had these professional relationships with, that you had these intimate health care type relationships with, those relationships were not so clearly distinguishable from your personal relationships.
Because they were your neighbors.
Yeah, you don't want to piss off the guy that's providing your eggs and your milk, for
right.
one. And why would you? You might be intermarried in their family anyway.
Right.
And the idea is that this is just kind of revisiting a very simple idea, that those kinds of conversations are still very much possible in the modern age. And really, are we utilizing our own dinner tables the way that we used to? It's kind of becoming an extinct phenomenon in the United States in particular.
So. Is it?
I mean, can't remember the last time my family sat down to a meal, and it wasn't the experience that I had growing up. I think that I've been in situations like that, but there's a lot more intent behind them. It's like an event when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people sit down, watch the television, eat their meals in shared isolation all too frequently, and the drive-thru has kind of replaced the stove or the oven in a lot of situations. So maybe sitting down talking to people in Uganda, in Juarez or wherever else, might be a reminder for people to sit next time they're seated at their own dinner table to turn to the person next to them and check in.
And have a real conversation. If only we could eat their food and they ours. Someday the technology might allow that.
Smell-o-vision. Willy Wonka vision.
So you wrote an article in the Santa Fe Reporter about the virtual dinner guest project in Mexico, and you will do the same for Uganda so people can check that out and keep your eyes open for it. And some very nice restaurants are helping out with this as well.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful for that. So Tom, which is a new restaurant, owned and run by the same people that do Max's on Guadalupe
okay.
Street. Tom just replaced what used to be Louis on, you're going to have to tell me the direction.
On the corner of Galisteo and West Alameda.
That's correct. East Alameda, actually. Or just, maybe no. I think it's just like Alameda. somewhere in between.
Maybe it's right where it turns from east
exactly,
to west, but yeah.
Exactly. And then the other restaurant, the Epizote for the second Juarez installment, and that will probably be in November.
And once again, Eric Maddox and the Virtual Dinner Guest Project are the finalists, or some of the finalists in the SPREAD event. SPREADSantaFe.com is where you can find out more about that. That's happening at Site Santa Fe on Friday, October 28th. And that's a great event because people can show up and break bread once again and vote for the many fine projects that are happening. And the Uganda Virtual Dinner Guest Project is on Saturday, October 22nd at 11 a.m. at Zane Bennett Contemporary Art. And people can contact Eric Maddox at virtualdinnerguestproject.com.
info@virtualdinnerguestproject.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ray Powell. He is the New Mexico Commissioner of Public Lands. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you and your listeners today on this beautiful fall day in New Mexico.
Indeed. So the New Mexico Commissioner of Public Lands, which is a title you held. It's an office that you held in the past, and you were reelected last year. What do you do? What does the land office do?
Well, Mary Charlotte, you're right. I was the land commissioner from 1993 through 2002, term limited out, went back to my veterinary practice, and over the last 5 years, I worked for Dr. Jane Goodall, the famed one of the world's top scientists. And I, through working with her, I met some of the world's experts. Her programs are in 140 countries around the globe on education, renewable energy, economic development, water issues. And through meeting some of those world experts, I decided, let's try these ideas back on state trust lands in New Mexico. And the land office is a very peculiar place in the sense that we look after 13 million acres of your and your listeners' public lands, and we generate revenues about $500 million a year to support our public schools, universities, and hospitals, and important institutions like Carrie Tingley Hospital for the developmentally challenged kids, the School for the Deaf, School for the Blind, the State Mental Hospital. These institutions are the very fabric of our state that really provide that safety net for the most vulnerable in the state, and the land office supplies $500 million for them. And our job at the land office is to take care of those lands, their working lands, while generating revenues so that they produce revenue and remain healthy for future generations.
Now, most of that revenue comes from oil and gas, doesn't it?
About 90% of it at this point comes from oil and gas, and we've been blessed with that, and it's helped educate virtually every child in New Mexico. The good news also is that we have as much in terms of potential income in decades to come from renewable energy.
How does that work?
Well, what we're finding is New Mexico has the ability to generate solar energy, wind energy, biomass, and geothermal at a par with, we think, these fossilized energies, oil, gas, coal, potash.
So instead of digging up the land or drilling into the land to get oil or gas out, you put solar panels and wind turbines on the land and still get money out of them?
And that's going to be the trick, and transmit that energy across state trust lands and charge for that transmission. The devil's always in the details, and while oil and gas is really important to our state, I just make two conditions, as they pay their fair share, every cent they owe, and that they take care of the health of the lands so that we're not ending up having to spend a large portion of that income cleaning things up.
Well, they're not exactly the cleanest industries, if I may say so.
Well, most of the problems that we're having now are ones that were inherited from the beginning of that industry. At this point in time, if all the rules and regulations are followed and the new technologies are utilized, it can be much safer than it was. But you have to have appropriate oversight and regulation of that. And as I say, when I'm at the land office, they need to pay their fair share. They need to take care of the health of those lands.
The famous Pitt Rule was passed during the Richardson administration. To what extent is that now actually being followed and therefore helping the groundwater not get contaminated?
Well, that's a real point of contention right now with the new administration. There's an Oil Conservation Commission. It's a three-member commission. Two members are appointed by the governor, and the state land commissioner appoints a person to that. And they are the ones that are now evaluating the Pitt Rule.
Is the Pitt Rule being followed? Has anybody lined their pits yet?
Well, I think during the last few years it was definitely followed, and the contention was whether this actually helped protect the land or whether it caused economic distress, which drove the industry off the land. I think the bottom line is, to me, is you've got to make sure that you're taking care of the health of the land, because if we contaminate particularly our groundwater, then there's no life in New Mexico. So we have to be very, very scrupulous and very careful in terms of making sure that we don't contaminate our groundwater. It's bad enough when we contaminate the surface But if we contaminate that groundwater, we're done here in New Mexico. So as we evaluate this pit rule and really look at it carefully, we cannot compromise the health and safety of our generation and future generations in terms of quality of water. And so from our standpoint at the land office, we're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that the groundwater is protected. As I said, oil and gas is important in terms of generating revenue to the state, but they've got to pay their fair share, and they've got to take care of the health of the land, which includes the health of that water.
The way that I'd like to see the economics of that is, what does it cost to line your pits versus what does it cost to treat a case of childhood leukemia?
Or to try and clean up water that causes that childhood leukemia, because
right.
It's so much less expensive to everybody, particularly those oil and gas companies. Just do it right from the beginning.
Right, right. The proverbial ounce of prevention.
Absolutely. And that goes not just for oil and gas, but any utilization of state trust land. We want to make sure that it's used, it's working land, it's the way it was set up in our Constitution, but that we be respectful of it and that we have it really in a healthy state so that all of the inhabitants of that land, whether they have wings or four legs, or they slither on the ground, have a place that is a quality place that sustains them, because we're all tied together. We're starting a program we had initiated when I was there at the land office in the past called One Health. And we're teaming with different universities around the country and our local universities. And the bottom line is healthy plants, healthy animals, healthy people. We're not separate. We're
right.
all tied together. And it is such a complex system that when we start tinkering with it without knowledge, we end up creating just a cascade of negative impacts that we're going to pay the price, but more importantly, our kids, our grandkids, and future generations are going to pay.
What's an example of that?
Well, you know, here in New Mexico, we have different diseases, West Nile virus, plague, hantavirus, rabies. And when we alter the health of those natural systems, oftentimes those diseases spike, and we end up with the human-animal interface actually resulting in spikes of these diseases. So we really have to monitor the health of the other species, not just ignore them or abuse them, because if they're healthy, we're going to be healthy.
So what you're saying is, if I hear right, is that wildlife is less likely to get sick and spread diseases if they're living in a healthy ecosystem.
Oh, absolutely. And if the wildlife is healthy, we're going to be healthy.
And you, one of your initiatives is planting native trees, which is not only good for the water, but also other migrating species that nest, for example, birds that nest in those trees.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, many of us live now in urban environments. Even though we are a very open state, the vast majority of people in New Mexico live in just a couple of communities. And we've lost many times that connection with the natural world. But we can retain it and actually improve it by around our houses, rather than planting plants that are from Africa or Asia. They're nice big green plants. The reason none of the insects eat them is because they're not from here. And the key...
They're not our food.
They're not our food. And we've got to get back to planting native plants that actually have insects that eat them, because then the birds and the lizards and the toads eat those insects, and we again start building that food chain to a healthy ecosystem, so you have things that are eating the mosquitoes.
We're talking to New Mexico Land Commissioner Ray Powell. It's funny, when I go to, I've started doing a little bit more planting in my little yard, and when I go to the nursery, I always buy the flowers that have bees on them. Just for that reason.
That's exactly right. Because if you look at what we've planted around our homes, we've actually created very sterile zones where all of the migratory wildlife passing through has nothing to eat. And, you know, most of us love to watch birds and to watch wildlife. Well, to throw out the welcome mat, pull up those introductions from Africa and Asia, plant native plants, they use much less water, They're much healthier over the long term, and they provide that food for that wildlife that we all love to enjoy and watch.
So you were land commissioner some years back. You're land commissioner now. What are you doing the same as you did before? What are you doing differently?
Well, what we're doing before that got lost over the last 8 years when we've been gone is really having sunshine at the land office, because what makes the office peculiar in New Mexico is part of our enabling legislation. The land commissioner is written into that constitution. The land commissioner can sell the land, lease the land, or trade the land without anybody else's approval. So if there's not sunshine and public involvement, you can get into trouble real fast.
What do you mean by sunshine?
Well, what I mean by sunshine is just having public meetings. I made the commitment, because this didn't happen over the last 8 years, that any sale, trade, or lease, we go to the community or the locality that is involved at the very beginning of a proposal, talk to the community, and see if this makes sense. Every piece of land we hold is held for one of 22 beneficiaries, so we go and talk to the beneficiaries, too.
What do you mean by beneficiaries?
They're the ones that whatever money's earned off of that piece of land goes to support
institutions the school like for the deaf and so on.
School for the blind, Carey Tingley Hospital, very important institutions. And if we don't do our job right, then we don't earn money off of that land. We cause irreparable damage to the health of the land, which we then have to put money in to get it healthy again, those important watersheds. But our taxpayers' bills go up.
Yeah.
So sunshine is just a matter of public involvement at the beginning of the process when it's important to get that public involvement, rather than trotting something out at the 11th hour that nobody can change.
Now, there was a land swap that I guess you reversed, the White Peaks land swap, when you came into office. What's the story of that?
Well, it was one of the motivations to run again. It's one of the most beautiful areas in the state of New Mexico, up in Mora and Colfax counties, and it's some of the best place to recreate, to hunt and fish. People have been using it for thousands of years because it is so productive and so beautiful. It's also an economic engine, Mary Charlotte, where we've got people coming from all over the country. They come, they want to recreate there, they bring their dollars, they buy gasoline, food, stay in motels. Well, over Christmas holidays 2 years ago, it got traded away. Without any sunshine, without any public involvement.
Is that, when you say sunshine, is like what other people call transparency?
Same thing.
Okay.
Same thing. Without public involvement. Because you can have transparency, but if you don't have public involvement, it doesn't mean much.
Right.
So it's a combination of public involvement and public participation.
Okay.
So the local communities that are going to be affected most have a voice in how trust lands are used.
So when something is done in secret over the Christmas holidays, that's, if I may say so, kind of a red flag.
It's a red flag, and it has a propensity to happen when people are trying to hide things.
Yeah.
And so this was a bad deal. We have an outstanding attorney general in the state that challenged it. I challenged it, and it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, this shouldn't have happened. They reversed it. And it was one of four exchanges. I canceled the first week I was back at the land office, the other three exchanges with private landowners, because it wasn't in the best interest of the trust, the public, local communities. And we're in the process. We've got the deeds back. People are back out recreating, hunting, and fishing on state trust land in that area. And that, once again, is in the public domain, and the public has access. But it almost vanished. And other parts of the state lost access to public lands because they were traded away, again, in my opinion, dead of night.
Traded for what?
Traded with other entities for other lands that weren't nearly as productive, and that resulted in a decline in revenue for these important institutions. They were land swaps or land sales.
Now, you oversee, or the Office of Public Lands oversees, millions and millions of acres, and we were talking about oil and gas before. What's your position on, for example, hydraulic fracturing? That's one of the ways of getting gas out of the ground, which is potentially so dangerous to the groundwater. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, and that's one of the issues we're faced with here in New Mexico in terms of the way we've siloed our ability to manage our lands. The agency that regulates that is in the Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources. So we at the land office lease our land, and then another agency oversees the activities that occur on that land, which make it really hard over the long term to have sustainably healthy land. Because
so you can't impose conditions.
We can't impose conditions, but we can sure use the bully pulpit, and we're strongly doing that. And that is that, again, and I keep using this word sunshine, transparency, any sort of activity like fracking on state trust lands or any place else needs to be done with full disclosure. What are we pumping down there? What are the risks? How might it contaminate groundwater?
And how has it done so in these places? I mean, I've seen more than one documentary about hydraulic fracturing or fracking where people set their, they turn on their water faucet and they hold a match up to it and the whole thing lights up.
Well, and apparently, and again, I'm not a geologist or a hydrologist, but if it's been done here in New Mexico, fracking, I'm told, for the last 30 years, and if there's the appropriate geology, then your risk doesn't go away completely, but it's much reduced. If you don't use the appropriate techniques with the appropriate geology, you can get into trouble real fast. And as we talked about before, once you contaminate your groundwater, then it would cost exponentially more to try and clean it up, and you're just in real trouble. So again, this fracking business has to be looked at very, very carefully, and it has to have it full disclosure of what we're pumping into the ground and what real risks are there. So this is a discussion that has to be held in public, not behind closed doors.
We're talking to New Mexico Commissioner of Public Lands, Ray Powell. So when you are looking at the big picture, New Mexico is a very big state. There's a lot of public land. You oversee a big chunk of these public trust lands. You need to get money out of them in the short run and the long run. Oil and gas are very important to the state. I have a gas stove. You know, I drive a car. We all do. Use these resources. But they will run out. That's an inevitability. It's like there's a pool, and when you drain the pool, there's nothing left. How do you see the long run? I mean, do you see former oil and gas lands being solar and wind lands? Or
Absolutely. But we have to invest, and I mean that, invest today for the future. This, many people look at it as an expense. It's an investment in our future. And right now, while we still have a lot of income coming in from oil and gas, we have to be investing in the renewable energies. And the real reality, there is no reason why we here in New Mexico can't lead the rest of the world, not only in production of renewable energies, but with our national laboratories and with our universities, we can lead the world in the technologies associated with them, which means, like Silicon Valley, we develop companies here in New Mexico that have that technological expertise, which New Mexicans can own, and then send our capable young people out across the world to apply those technologies, but have the checks come back to New Mexico.
Right.
That's not a pipe dream. We can do that if we have the will, the vision, and the motivation to really look seven generations ahead instead of one political cycle ahead.
Yeah, or a quarterly corporate profit cycle.
Exactly. We're doomed if we let that sort of corporate greed be what's driving us versus quality of life and looking at optimizing revenues from the trust over generations, not a boom and bust mentality.
Right. Now, how do you, I mean, is it a balancing act to, I know you're interested in not only, I mean, you're a veterinarian, but you're particularly interested in wildlife veterinary medicine and have a very great interest in maintaining healthy ecosystems with wildlife on it. Is there a balancing act between, on the one hand, generating revenue from public land and on the other hand, keeping wildlife ecosystems truly healthy and thriving?
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's how we prioritize things. And when we look at why most of us have chosen to live in New Mexico, it's because of the quality of life and the fact that we do have wildlife and that we can go out and view them. And that we're part of that those systems, and we can go hike in the mountains, and we can go fish and hunt or take pictures of birds or view butterflies. That's why we've chosen to live here.
Sometimes there's foxes in our yards and skunks.
We are not different from the natural world. We are part of the natural world. And what's critically important is that, again, we reconnect with that natural world. And you bet, we have choices to make. Every choice you make has consequences. We've got to start looking at the big picture over a long period of time and ensure that future generations have not just as good of an experience as we've had, but hopefully a better one, because we have so much more knowledge now. And, you know, it's just inconceivable to me that we'd have New Mexico being just a big smokestack with no wildlife, no blue skies, no trees, because we have so severely neglected it or overused it. That's unacceptable.
And that is a real danger.
It's a danger if we don't use thoughtful purposes as we walk on that land and try and use as light a footprint as we can. So when we make our decisions, think about the short-term, mid-term, and particularly the long-term consequences.
The website for the Public Lands Office is nmstatelands.org. How can people get involved if they have opinions or thoughts or questions and they want to talk to somebody at the land office?
It would just give us a call, go to the website, and we have a number of lectures and activities at the land office. We have an auditorium there. And on our website, we'll have scheduled events. People come over. But
There's a film coming up about wolves.
There is, at the end of this month.
We're going to do an interview on that.
And Elke Durer, who is the photographer and the person that's putting that film together, has a real passion for the natural world and for wolves. And we're really thrilled that she's going to premiere her movie at the land office.
And that's on the 28th of October at the land office. So we'll be giving more information about that. Ray Powell, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And people can go to nmstatelands.org. And I hope you come back again another time.
Mary Charlotte, again, thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you and your listeners. And I invite you to come to the land office anytime along with your listeners. It's your public lands.
Thank you. And we'll see you soon. And by the way, the telephone number at the Public Lands Office is 505-827-5760. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce Joe West. His group, Joe West and the Santa Fe Review, is playing this Friday, October 14th, at El Museo Cultural. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you, too. Just getting to know your music. Tell us, give us kind of an introduction to your world of music.
I'm sort of a narrative-based folk singer is what I would describe myself as. I'm a Santa Fe person, spent some time in Texas and some time in New York City as a theater person in my past, but over the last 15, 20 years have been a songwriter and storyteller, performer. And I would say a lot of my narratives in song have, over the last 10 years, have certainly encompassed life in northern New Mexico and Santa Fe. And
what are some of the tales you tell?
Oh, well, anyone who kind of knows, has come to any of my shows or the Santa Fe All-Stars has certainly heard stories like Trip to Roswell, New Mexico, and $2,000 Navajo rug, where the girl sweeps him under the $2,000 Navajo rug and things like that. Jam bands in Colorado. What's another? there's a series of stories about Jamie, who is the girl from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, who was sort of a heartbreaking situation, and there's little narratives of her life that weave in and out of South Dakota and New Mexico, and they're all kind of autobiographical and based a little bit on my adventures.
So you're basically telling the stories of this area and getting ready to take them on the road, almost like a troubadour takes the story from one place and tells them somewhere else.
Yeah. I think the concept of this show is sort of thinking that there's a certain... I think my work sort of encompasses community and locale and stories that are really based and derived from there and characters. And Arnie Bay is sort of the producer, and he kind of came up with the concept of thinking that there's something really universal about my work and how it kind of is a sense of community in other places too, and to do it as a small touring show, kind of a Will Rogers Follies type thing.
Where are you going to go?
Well, we're going to go all over. We're going to start as a show. We're going to just build it regionally. This winter we're going to probably go to the Midwest in the middle of winter, like to the northern regions, which is probably the worst thing we could possibly do.
I was going to say, shouldn't you go to the Midwest when they're having festivals?
That's exactly. Well, I have a lot of history up there because I spent some time growing up in South Dakota. I'm from Santa Fe, but I went to college in South Dakota, and I studied theater and went to Minnesota for a couple of years, and Wisconsin have it like this. So I have a lot. I've always toured up there. So this winter we'll be doing kind of a follow-up on my circuit up there with this show.
Should we hear a little bit of music right now?
Well, sure. There's, if I was to suggest one of, this is my Human Cannonball CD that has sort of great Santa Fe story. It would be Jam Bands in Colorado. Or
I've heard Jam Bands in Colorado. That's not the song, but the actual
phenomenon. Well, that's sort of the joke of the song. And Cowgirl Hall of Fame is a very Santa Fe story. Heaven's very sweet. Oklahoma Bound's fun. Oh, Anita Pita is one that also showed up on my children's album, and that's very Santa Fe.
Well, let's hear one of those, and thank you for being with us, and we'll see you this Friday at El Museo Cultural at what time?
8 o'clock, Mary Charlotte.
8 o'clock. Well, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you for giving us a plug on the show.
And it's sort of last minute, so we hope you come back for a longer one soon.
I'm sure I will.
And we're going to go out with Jam Bands in Colorado.
There's a lot of jam bands in Colorado. There's a lot of jam. My buddy Paul went up to Denver for a show, but he ended up breaking down just south of Pueblo. Right when he thought his plans were all shot to hell, up drove some girls that he knew pretty well. They had a carload of mushrooms and pot. In fact, they had more than just a lot. Paul was a nervous type, and he began to sweat, but he saw a string cheese show he'd never forget. There's a lot of jam bands in Colorado. There's a lot of jam bands in Colorado. I guess I've lived a life.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Lexi Shabel. She's a filmmaker. She's founder and director of the Breast Wishes Fund. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be back.
So we've talked about your organization before. Just remind us what it's about.
Breast Wishes Fund improves access to integrative breast cancer education and wellness for women of all ages, and was founded by me.
And you've been living with breast cancer for 6 years.
Just had my 6-year anniversary.
And you did chemotherapy, but everything else you've done has basically been integrative medicine and other ways of dealing with it, and you're healthy as can be.
This is true through many trials and errors, and using myself as a guinea pig and as a filmmaker making a film called The Me Film, which there's clips for online at breastwishesfund.org. You can kind of see my progress from being in a hysterical state back east with my family to, giving myself whatever treatment it may be myself. And one of the things that we'll have at our free integrative medicine educational forum is me giving my DIY inexpensive cancer protocol. Because this winter, I really feel like I boiled it down to something where you almost don't need any other practitioners.
Very interesting. Now, you are having an event tonight at Amavi, which is your annual fundraiser.
Well, this is really the first of its kind. It's our high-end happy hour fundraiser, and our other events are free. So this one we're very excited about. Megan Tucker, who's hot chef here in Santa Fe, she's developed a very feminine-inspired menu, and we'll have cosmos and all kinds of fun libations. And just to really, reintroduce ourselves to the community as a local resource. Our goals are to be national, but right now we are here and we are sponsoring lots of events here and really want to help the communities.
So people can go to Amavi tonight for your high-end happy hour. Now on Thursday, the 20th of October, there's another event.
Yes, we're the wow factor at Mix, Mix Santa Fe, which is going to be at Inn at Loretto, and we are doing breast print party because of John.
That has another name, but we can't say it because of the FCC.
And John Carlin. George Carlin. John Carlin, somebody I went to college with.
George, so look up George Carlin, seven words, ladies and gentlemen, and you know the word we're not saying. So you can a breast print party, yes.
A breast print party at Inn at Loretto, and they're just super fun and really empowering for women. And our second annual free integrative medicine educational forum is Saturday, October 22nd, and that's from 10 o'clock till 6 p.m. It's going to be at Center for Progress and Justice between 2nd Street and Baca. And
that's 1420 Cerrillos Road.
And we're super excited about that this year, and just thrilled to be offering it for the second time, offering it free to the public. We'll be doing a raw, cancer-free cooking class with a complimentary lunch, woman-centric Qigong, and lots of breast health awareness, discussions about the lymphatic system, cancer chemicals in the environment, and also, like I said, I'll be giving my DIY inexpensive cancer protocol.
Do-it-yourself inexpensive cancer protocol, which is really, as I gather from you, far outside of the medical protocol, and who probably wouldn't approve of what you're doing.
I think that there has been many paths that have led me to being what might come off as brash and cocky at this point. And this, I have just celebrated my 6 years of living with cancer this way and living with both my breasts because I chose not to have surgery. So I think that if I do come off as sounding cocky, it's because I have gone through the gauntlet of complementary, alternative, integrative, allopathic, every type of medicine. And because I'm a filmmaker and I've been making a film, and at breastwishesfund.org, you can also see a trailer for the Me film, which is in post-production right now. You can really see how this process, there's at one point where I look straight at the camera and I say, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm actually considering double mastectomies today. I'm the fourth generation of Shea Bell to have breast cancer. But I am the first generation to still have both my breasts. And I think that I had a karmic score to settle. Everybody's dead, in my family from who did have breast cancer, though they lived for quite some time, but I watched them get whittled away. And so it's been my question of, can you live with this?
Lexi Shea Bell is a filmmaker. She's founder of the Breast Wishes Fund, which is at breastwishesfund.org. We're just about out of time right now, but we'll see you at Amavi tonight, and we'll see you at these other events on the 20th and the 22nd of October. Once again, you can go to breastwishesfund.org for more information. Lexi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.